the story of his encounter with Karisaip's ghost. It happened 2 years ago, he said. He had gone across the river, hunting for a nutmeg tree to make a paste of nutmeg and fresh garlic for Chella, his wife, as she lay dying of tuberculosis. Suddenly, he smelled cigar smoke, which he recognized at once because Papachi used to smoke the same brand. Velipapan whirled around and hurled his sickle at the smell. He pinned the ghost to the trunk of a rubber tree where, according to Velipapan, it still remained. A sickled smell that bled clear amber blood and begged for cigars. Velipapan never found the nutmeg tree and had to buy himself a new sickle. But he had the satisfaction of knowing that his lightning-quick reflexes, despite his mortgaged eye, and his presence of mind, had put an end to the bloodthirsty wanderings of a pedophile ghost. As long as no one succumbed to its artifice and unsickled it with a cigar. What Velipapan, who knew most things, didn't know, was that Karisaip's house was the history house, whose doors were locked and windows open. And that inside, map-breathed ancestors, with tough toenails, whispered to the lizards on the wall. That history used the back veranda to negotiate its terms and collect its dues. That default led to dire consequences. That on the day history picked to square its books, Esther would keep the receipt for the dues that Velitha paid. Velipapan had no idea that Karisaip it was who captured dreams and redreamed them. That he plucked them from the minds of passers-by the way children pick currants from a cake. That the ones he craved most of all, the dreams he loved redreaming, were the tender dreams of two egg twins. Poor old Velipapan. Had he known then that history would choose him for its deputy, that it would be his tears that set the terror rolling, perhaps he would not have strutted like a young cockerel in the Imanum Bazaar, bragging of how he swam the river with his sickle in his mouth, sour, the taste of iron on his tongue. How he put it down for just one moment, while he kneeled to wash the river grit out of his mortgaged eye. There was grit in the river sometimes, particularly in the rainy months. When he caught the first whiff of cigar smoke. How he picked up his sickle, whirled around, and sickled the smell that fixed the ghost forever. All in a single, fluid, athletic motion. By the time he understood his part in history's plans, it was too late to retrace his steps. He had swept his footprints away himself, crawling backwards with a broom. In the factory, the silence swooped down once more and tightened around the twins, but this time it was a different kind of silence, an old river silence, the silence of fisher people and waxy mermaids. But communists don't believe in ghosts, Esther said, as though they were continuing a discourse investigating solutions to the ghost problem. Their conversations surfaced and dipped like mountain streams, sometimes audible to other people, sometimes not. Are we going to become a communist? Rahel asked. Might have to. Esther the practical. Distant, cake-crumbled voices and approaching Blue Army footsteps caused the comrades to seal the secret. It was pickled, sealed, and put away. A red, tender mango-shaped secret in a vat, presided over by a Naul. The red agenda was worked out and agreed upon. Comrade Rahel would go for her afternoon gnap, then lie awake until Amu fell asleep. Comrade Esther would find the flag that Baby Kuchma had been forced to wave, and wait for her by the river, and there they would be, prepared to prepare to be prepared. A child's abandoned fairy frock, semi-pickled, stood stiffly on its own in the middle of Amu's darkened bedroom floor. Outside, the air was alert and bright and hot. Rahel lay next to Amu, wide awake in her matching airport knickers. She could see the pattern of the cross-stitch flowers from the blue cross-stitch counterpane on Amu's cheek. She could hear the blue cross-stitch afternoon. The slow ceiling fan. The sun behind the curtains. The yellow wasp wasping against the window pane in a dangerous zzzz. A disbelieving lizard's blink. High-stepping chickens in the yard. The sound of the sun crinkling the washing. Crisping white bedsheets. Stiffening starched saris. Off-white and gold. Red ants on yellow stones. A hot cow feeling hot. A moo in the distance. And the smell of a cunning Englishman ghost, sickled to a rubber tree, asking courteously for a cigar. Excuse me, you wouldn't happen to have an, cigar, would you? In a kind, schoolteacherly voice. Oh, dear. And Esther waiting for her, by the river. Under the mangosteen tree that Reverend E. John Ipe had brought home from his visit to Mandalay. What was Esther sitting on? On what they always sat on, under the mangosteen tree, something grey and grizzled, covered in moss and lichen, smothered in ferns, something that the earth had claimed. Not a log. Not a rock. Before she completed the thought, Rahel was up and running. Through the kitchen, past Gotcha Maria fast asleep, thick wrinkled, like a sudden rhinoceros in a frilly apron. Past the factory, tumbling barefoot through the green heat, followed by a yellow wasp. Comrade Esther was there, under the mangosteen tree, with the red flag planted in the earth beside him. A mobile republic, a twin revolution with a puff. And what was he sitting on? Something covered with moss, hidden by ferns. Knock on it, and it made a hollow, knocked-on sound. The silence dipped and soared and swooped and looped in figures of eight. Jeweled dragonflies hovered like shrill children's voices in the sun. Finger-colored fingers fought the ferns, moved the stones, cleared the way. There was a sweaty grappling for an edge to hold on to, and a one, two, and... Things can change in a day. It was a boat. A tiny wooden warlam. The boat that Esther sat on and Rahel found. The boat that Amu would use to cross the river, to love by night the man her children loved by day. So old a boat that it had taken root. Almost. A grey old boat plant. With boat flowers and boat fruit, and underneath, a boat-shaped patch of withered grass. A scurrying, hurrying boat world. Dark and dry and cool. Unroofed now, and blind. White termites on their way to work. White ladybirds on their way home. White beetles burrowing away from the light. White grasshoppers with white wood violins. Sad white music. A white wasp, dead. A brittle white snakeskin, preserved in darkness, crumbled in the sun. But would it do, that little warlam? Was it perhaps too old, too dead? Was Akkara too far away for it? Two egg twins looked out across their river, the Meenachil, grey-green, with fish in it. The sky and trees in it, and at night, the broken yellow moon in it. When Papachi was a boy, an old tamarind tree fell into it in a storm. It was still there, a smooth, barkless tree blackened by a surfeit of green water, driftless driftwood. The first third of the river was their friend, before the really deep began. They knew the slippery stone steps, 13, before the slimy mud began. They knew the afternoon weed that flowed inwards from the backwaters of Komaragam. They knew the smaller fish, the flat, foolish parlati, the silver paral, the wily, whiskered kuri, the sometimes karimin. Here, Charco had taught them to swim, splashing around his ample uncle's stomach without help. Here they had discovered for themselves the disconnected delights of underwater farting. Here they had learned to fish, to thread coiling purple earthworms onto hooks on the fishing rods that Relitha made from slender culms of yellow bamboo. Here they studied silence, like the children of the fisher people, and learned the bright language of dragonflies. Here they learned to wait, to watch, to think thoughts and not voice them, to move like lightning when the bendy yellow bamboo arced downwards. So this first third of the river they knew well. The next two-thirds, less so. The second third was where the really deep began, where the current was swift and certain, downstream when the tide was out, upstream, pushing up from the backwaters when the tide was in. The third third was shallow again, the water brown and murky, full of weeds and darting eels and slow mud that oozed through toes like toothpaste. The twins could swim like seals, and supervised by Charco had crossed the river several times, returning panting and cross-eyed from the effort with a stone, a twig, or a leaf from the other side as testimony to their feet. But the middle of a respectable river, or the other side, was no place for children to linger, loll, or learn things. Esther and Rahel accorded the second third and the third third of the Meenachil the deference it deserved. Still, swimming across was not the problem. Taking the boat with things in it, so that they could be prepare to be prepared, was. They looked across the river with old boat eyes. From where they stood, they couldn't see the history house. It was just a darkness beyond the swamp, at the heart of the abandoned rubber estate, from which the sound of crickets swelled. Esther and Rahel lifted the little boat and carried it to the water. It looked surprised, like a grizzled fish that had surfaced from the deep, in dire need of sunlight. It needed scraping and cleaning, perhaps, but nothing more. Two happy hearts soared like colored kites in a sky-blue sky. But then, in a slow green whisper, the river, with fish in it, with the sky and trees in it, bubbled in. Slowly the old boat sank and settled on the sixth step, and a pair of two-egg twin hearts sank and settled on the step above the sixth. The deep-swimming fish covered their mouths with their fins and laughed sideways at the spectacle. A white boat spider floated up with the river in the boat, struggled briefly, and drowned. Her white egg sac ruptured prematurely, and 100 baby spiders, too light to drown, too small to swim, stippled the smooth surface of the green water before being swept out to sea. To Madagascar, to start a new phylum of Malayali swimming spiders. In a while, as though they'd discussed it, though they hadn't, the twins began to wash the boat in the river. The cobwebs, the mud, the moss and lichen floated away. When it was clean, they turned it upside down and hoisted it onto their heads, like a combined hat that dripped. Esther uprooted the red flag. A small procession, a flag, a wasp, and a boat on legs, wended its knowledgeable way down the little path through the undergrowth. It avoided the clumps of nettles and sidestepped known ditches and anthills. It skirted the precipice of the deep pit from which laterite had been quarried, and was now a still lake with steep orange banks, the thick, viscous water covered with a luminous film of green scum, a verdant, treacherous lawn in which mosquitoes bred, and fish were fat but inaccessible. The path, which ran parallel to the river, led to a little grassy clearing that was hemmed in by huddled trees, coconut, cashew, mango, bilimbi. On the edge of the clearing, with its back to the river, a low hut with walls of orange laterite plastered with mud and a thatched roof, nestled close to the ground, as though it was listening to a whispered subterranean secret. The low walls of the hut were the same color as the earth they stood on, and seemed to have germinated from a house seed planted in the ground, from which right-angled ribs of earth had risen and enclosed space. Three untidy banana trees grew in the little front yard that had been fenced off with panels of woven palm leaves. The boat on legs approached the hut. An unlit oil lamp hung on the wall beside the door. The patch of wall behind it was singed, soot black. The door was ajar. It was dark inside. A black hen appeared in the doorway. She returned indoors, entirely indifferent to boat visits. Velitha wasn't home, nor Veljepappen. But someone was. A man's voice floated out from inside and echoed around the clearing, making him sound lonely. The voice shouted the same thing over and over again, and each time it climbed into a higher, more hysterical register. It was an appeal to an overripe guava threatening to fall from its tree and make a mess on the ground.
Pa-pera-pera-pera-pera-pera-pera-pera. Mr. Gaga-gaga-guava. Ende parambilturale.
Don't shit here in my compound.
Chetende parambilturikyo.
You can shit next door in my brother's compound.
Papera vera vera perekya. Mr. Gaga-gaga-guava.
The shouter was Kuttappan, Velitha's older brother. He was paralyzed from his chest downwards. Day after day, month after month, while his brother was away and his father went to work, Kuttappan lay flat on his back and watched his youth saunter past without stopping to say hello. All day he lay there, listening to the silence of huddled trees, with only a domineering black hen for company. He missed his mother, Chella, who had died in the same corner of the room that he lay in now. She had died a coughing, spitting, aching, phlegmy death. Kuttappan remembered noticing how her feet died long before she had, how the skin on them grew gray and lifeless, how fearfully he watched death creep over her from the bottom up. Kuttappan kept vigil on his own numb feet with mounting terror. Occasionally he poked at them hopefully with a stick that he kept propped up in the corner to defend himself against visiting snakes. He had no sensation in his feet at all, and only visual evidence assured him that they were still connected to his body and were indeed his own. After Chella died, he was moved into her corner, the corner that Kuttappan imagined was the corner of his home that death had reserved to administer her deathly affairs. One corner for cooking, one for clothes, one for bedding rolls, one for dying in. He wondered how long his would take, and what people who had more than four corners in their houses did with the rest of their corners. Did it give them a choice of corners to die in? He assumed, not without reason, that he would be the first in his family to follow in his mother's wake. He would learn otherwise. Soon. Too soon. Sometimes, from habit, from missing her, Kuttappan coughed like his mother used to, and his upper body bucked like a just-caught fish. His lower body lay like lead, as though it belonged to someone else, someone dead, whose spirit was trapped and couldn't get away. Unlike Velitha, Kuttappan was a good, safe Padavan. He could neither read nor write. As he lay there on his hard bed, bits of thatch and grit fell onto him from the ceiling and mingled with his sweat. Sometimes ants and other insects fell with it. On bad days, the orange walls held hands and bent over him, inspecting him like malevolent doctors, slowly, deliberately, squeezing the breath out of him and making him scream. Sometimes they receded of their own accord, and the room he lay in grew impossibly large, terrorizing him with the specter of his own insignificance. That too made him cry out. Insanity hovered close at hand, like an eager waiter at an expensive restaurant, lighting cigarettes, refilling glasses. Kuttappan thought with envy of madmen who could walk. He had no doubts about the equity of the deal. His sanity, for serviceable legs. The twins put the boat down and the clatter was met with a sudden silence from inside. Kuttappan wasn't expecting anyone. Esther and Rahel pushed open the door and went in. Small as they were, they had to stoop a little to go in. The wasp waited outside on the lamp. "It's us." The room was dark and clean. It smelled of fish curry and wood smoke. Heat cleaved to things like a low fever. But the mud floor was cool under Rahel's bare feet. Velitha and Velyapapan's bedding was rolled up and propped against the wall. Clothes hung on a string. There was a low wooden kitchen shelf on which covered terracotta pots, ladles made of coconut shells, and three chipped enamel plates with dark blue rims were arranged. A grown man could stand up straight in the center of the room, but not along its sides. Another low door led to a backyard where there were more banana trees, beyond which the river glimmered through the foliage. A carpenter's workstation had been erected in the backyard. There were no keys or cupboards to lock. The black hen left through the back door and scratched abstractedly in the yard where wood shavings blew about like blonde curls. Judging from her personality, she appeared to have been reared on a diet of hardware, hasps and clasps and nails and old screws.
"Ayo, Mon, Mol, what must you be thinking, that Kuttappan's a basket case?" an embarrassed, disembodied voice said.
It took the twins a while for their eyes to grow accustomed to the dark. Then the darkness dissolved, and Kuttappan appeared on his bed, a glistening genie in the gloom. The whites of his eyes were dark yellow. The soles of his feet, soft from so much lying down, stuck out from under the cloth that covered his legs. They were still stained a pale orange from years of walking barefoot on red mud. He had gray calluses on his ankles from the chafing of the rope that Paravans tied around their feet when they climbed coconut trees. On the wall behind him, there was a benign, mouse-haired calendar Jesus, with lipstick and rouge, and a lurid, jeweled heart glowing through his clothes. The bottom quarter of the calendar, the part with the dates on it, frilled out like a skirt. Jesus in a mini. 12 layers of petticoats, for the 12 months of the year. None had been torn out. There were other things from the Imanam house that had either been given to them or salvaged from the rubbish bin. Rich things in a poor house. A clock that didn't work. A flowered tin waste paper basket. Papachi's old riding boots, brown with green mold, with the cobbler's trees still in them. Biscuit tins, with sumptuous pictures of English castles and ladies with bustles and ringlets. A small poster, Baby Kuchma's, given away because of a damp patch, hung next to Jesus. It was a picture of a blonde child writing a letter with tears falling down her cheeks. Underneath it said, "I'm writing to say I miss you." She looked as though she'd had a haircut, and it was her cropped curls that were blowing around Relitha's backyard. A transparent plastic tube led from under the worn cotton sheet that covered Kuttappan to a bottle of yellow liquid that caught the shaft of light that came in through the door and quelled a question that had been rising inside Rahel. She fetched him water in a steel tumbler from the clay kuja. She seemed to know her way around. Kuttappan lifted his head and drank. Some water dribbled down his chin. The twins squatted on their haunches, like professional adult gossips in the Imanam market. They sat in silence for a while. Kuttappan mortified, the twins preoccupied with boat thoughts.
"Has Chakosar's mall come?" Kuttappan asked.
"Must have," Rahel said laconically.
"Where's she?"
"Who knows? Must be around somewhere. We don't know."
Will you bring her here for me to see?
Can't, Rahel said. Why not?
She has to stay indoors. She's very delicate. If she gets dirty, she'll die.
I see. We're not allowed to bring her here, and anyway, there's nothing to see, Rahel assured Kuttappan. She has hair, legs, teeth, you know, the usual, only she's a little tall. And that was the only concession she would make.
Is that all? Kuttappan said, getting the point very quickly.
Then where's the point in seeing her?
No point, Rahel said.
Kuttappa, if a vellum leaks, is it very hard to mend? Esther asked.
Shouldn't be, Kuttappan said.
Depends.
Why? Whose vellum is leaking?
Ours, that we found. Do you want to see it?
They went out and returned with the grizzled boat for the paralyzed man to examine. They held it over him like a roof. Water dripped on him.
First, we'll have to find the leaks, Kuttappan said. Then we'll have to plug them.
Then sandpaper, Esther said. Then polish.
Then oars, Rahel said.
Then oars, Esther agreed.
Then offity off, Rahel said.
Where to? Kuttappan asked.
Just here and there, Esther said airily.
You must be careful, Kuttappan said. This river of ours, she isn't always what she pretends to be.
What does she pretend to be? Rahel asked.
Oh, a little old church-going amuma, quiet and clean, idiyappams for breakfast, kanyi and mean for lunch, minding her own business, not looking right or left.
And she's really a...
really a wild thing. I can hear her at night, rushing past in the moonlight, always in a hurry. You must be careful of her.
And what does she really eat?
Really eat? Oh, stew. And he cast about for something English for the evil river to eat.
Pineapple slices, Rahel suggested.
That's right, pineapple slices and stew. And she drinks whiskey.
And brandy.
And brandy, true. And looks right and left.
True.
And minds other people's business.
Esthapan steadied the little boat on the uneven earth floor with a few blocks of wood that he found in Velitha's workstation in the backyard. He gave Rahel a cooking ladle made of a wooden handle stuck through the polished half of a coconut shell. The twins climbed into the vellum and rowed across vast, choppy waters. With a teide tagateide thom, and a jeweled Jesus watching.
He walked on water,
perhaps.
But could he have swum on land?
In matching knickers and dark glasses, with his fountain in a love in Tokyo, in pointy shoes and a puff? Would he have had the imagination?
Velitha returned to see if Kuttappan needed anything. From a distance he heard the raucous singing, young voices underlining with delight the scatology.
Hey, Mr. Monkey Man, why's your bum so red? I went for a shit to Madras and scraped it till it bled.
Temporarily, for a few happy moments, the orange drink lemon drink man shut his yellow smile and went away. Fear sank and settled at the bottom of the deep water, sleeping a dog's sleep, ready to rise and murk things at a moment's notice. Velitha smiled when he saw the Marxist flag blooming like a tree outside his doorway. He had to bend low in order to enter his home, a tropical Eskimo. When he saw the children, something clenched inside him, and he couldn't understand it. He saw them every day. He loved them without knowing it. But it was different suddenly, now, after history had slipped up so badly. No fist had clenched inside him before. Her children, an insane whisper whispered to him. Her eyes, Her mouth. Her teeth. Her soft, lambent skin. He drove the thought away angrily. It returned and sat outside his skull like a dog.
Huh? He said to his young guests. And who, may I ask, are these fisher people?
Esta papi chachin kutapen pitamon, Mr. and Mrs. Pleased to meet you.
Rahel held out her ladle to be shaken in greeting. It was shaken in greeting.
Hers?
Then Esther's.
And where, may I ask, are they off to by boat?
Off to Africa, Rahel shouted.
Stop shouting, Esther said. Velitha walked around the boat. They told him where they had found it.
So it doesn't belong to anybody,
Rahel said a little doubtfully, because it suddenly occurred to her that it might.
Ought we to report it to the police?
Don't be stupid, Esther said. Velitha knocked on the wood and then scraped a little patch clean with his nail.
Good wood, he said.
It sinks, Esther said. It leaks. Can you mend it for us, Velitha Papichach and Petermon? Rahel asked.
We'll see about that, Velitha said. I don't want you playing any silly games on this river.
We won't, we promise. We'll use it only when you're with us.
First, we'll have to find the leaks, Velitha said.
Then we'll have to plug them,
the twins shouted, as though it was the second line of a well-known poem.
How long will it take? Esther asked.
A day, Velitha said.
A day? I thought you'd say a month.
Esther, delirious with joy, jumped on Velitha, wrapped his legs around his waist and kissed him. The sandpaper was divided into exactly equal halves, and the twins fell to work with an eerie concentration that excluded everything else. Boat dust flew around the room and settled on hair and eyebrows, on Kutupan like a cloud, on Jesus like an offering. Velitha had to prise the sandpaper out of their fingers.
Not here, he said firmly. Outside.
He picked the boat up and carried it out. The twins followed, eyes fixed on their boat with unwavering concentration, starving puppies expecting to be fed. Velitha set the boat up for them, the boat that Esther sat on and Rahel found. He showed them how to follow the grain of the wood. He started them off on the sandpapering. When he returned indoors, the black hen followed him, determined to be wherever the boat wasn't. Velitha dipped a thin cotton towel in an earthen pot of water. He squeezed the water out of it, savagely, as though it was an unwanted thought, and handed it to Kutupan to wipe the grit off his face and neck.
Did they say anything? Kutupan asked. About seeing you in the march?
No, Velitha said. Not yet. They will, though. They know.
For sure?
Velitha shrugged and took the towel away to wash, and rinse, and beat, and wring, as though it was his ridiculous, disobedient brain. He tried to hate her. She's one of them, he told himself. Just another one of them. He couldn't. She had deep dimples when she smiled. Her eyes were always somewhere else. Madness slunk in through a chink in history. It only took a moment. An hour into the sandpapering, Rahel remembered her afternoon gnap, and she was up and running, tumbling through the green afternoon heat, followed by her brother and a yellow wasp, hoping, praying that Amu hadn't woken up and found her gone. Chapter 11. The God of Small Things. That afternoon, Amu traveled upwards through a dream in which a cheerful man with one arm held her close by the light of an oil lamp. He had no other arm with which to fight the shadows that flickered around him on the floor, shadows that only he could see. Ridges of muscle on his stomach rose under his skin like divisions on a slab of chocolate. He held her close by the light of an oil lamp,
and he shone as though he had been polished with a high wax body polish. He could do only one thing at a time. If he held her, he couldn't kiss her. If he kissed her, he couldn't see her. If he saw her, he couldn't feel her. She could have touched his body lightly with her fingers and felt his smooth skin turn to goose flesh. She could have let her fingers stray to the base of his flat stomach, carelessly over those burnished chocolate ridges, and left patterned trails of bumpy goose flesh on his body, like flat chalk on a blackboard, like a swathe of breeze in a paddy field, like jet streaks in a blue church sky. She could so easily have done that, but she didn't. He could have touched her too, but he didn't. Because in the gloom beyond the oil lamp, in the shadows, there were metal folding chairs, arranged in a ring. And on the chairs there were people with slanting rhinestone sunglasses, watching. They all held polished violins under their chins, the bows poised at identical angles. They all had their legs crossed, left over right, and all their left legs were shivering. Some of them had newspapers, some didn't. Some of them blew spit bubbles, some didn't. But they all had the flickering reflection of an oil lamp on each lens. Beyond the circle of folding chairs was a beach, littered with broken blue glass bottles. The silent waves brought new blue bottles to be broken and dragged the old ones away in the undertow. There were jagged sounds of glass on glass. On a rock out at sea, in a shaft of purple light, there was a mahogany and wicker rocking chair. Smashed. The sea was black, the spume vomit green. Fish fed on shattered glass. Night's elbows rested on the water, and falling stars glanced off its brittle shards. Moths lit up the sky. There wasn't a moon. He could swim with his one arm, she with her two. His skin was salty, hers too. He left no footprints in sand, no ripples in water, no image in mirrors. She could have touched him with her fingers, but she didn't. They just stood together, still, skin to skin. A powdery colored breeze lifted her hair and blew it like a rippled shawl around his armless shoulder that ended abruptly, like a cliff. A thin red cow with a protruding pelvic bone appeared and swam straight out to sea, without wetting her horns, without looking back. Amu flew through her dream on heavy, shuddering wings and stopped to rest just under the skin of it. She had pressed roses from the blue cross-stitch counterpane on her cheek. She sensed her children's faces hanging over her dream, like two dark, worried moons waiting to be let in. "Do you think she's dying?" she heard Rahel whisper to Esther. "It's an afternoon mare," Esther the accurate replied. "She dreams a lot." If he touched her, he couldn't talk to her. If he loved her, he couldn't leave. If he spoke, he couldn't listen. If he fought, he couldn't win. Who was he, the one-armed man? Who could he have been? The god of loss, the god of small things, the god of goosebumps and sudden smiles, of sour metal smells, like steel bus rails and the smell of the bus conductor's hands from holding them? "Should we wake her up?" Esther said. Chinks of late afternoon light stole into the room through the curtains and fell on Amu's tangerine-shaped transistor radio that she always took with her to the river. Tangerine-shaped, too, was the thing that Esther carried into the Sound of Music in his sticky other hand. Bright bars of sunlight brightened Amu's tangled hair. She waited, under the skin of her dream, not wanting to let her children in. "She says you should never wake dreaming people suddenly," Rahel said. "She says they could easily have a heart attack." Between them, they decided that it would be best to disturb her discreetly rather than wake her suddenly. So they opened drawers, they cleared their throats, they whispered loudly, they hummed a little tune.
They moved shoes and found a cupboard door that creaked. Amu, resting under the skin of her dream, observed them and ached with her love for them. The one-armed man blew out his lamp and walked across the jagged beach, away into the shadows that only he could see. He left no footprints on the shore. The folding chairs were folded, the black sea smoothed, the creased waves ironed, the spume rebottled, the bottle corked, the night postponed till further notice. Amu opened her eyes. It was a long journey that she made, from the embrace of the one-armed man to her unidentical two-egg twins. "You were having an afternoon mare," her daughter informed her. "It wasn't a mare," Amu said. "It was a dream." "Esther thought you were dying." "You looked so sad," Esther said. "I was happy," Amu said, and realized that she had been. "If you're happy in a dream, Amu, does that count?" Esther asked.
"Does what count?"
"The happiness, does it count?" She knew exactly what he meant, her son with his spoiled puff. Because the truth is that only what counts, counts. The simple, unswerving wisdom of children. If you eat fish in a dream, does it count? Does it mean you've eaten fish? The cheerful man without footprints, did he count? Amu groped for her tangerine transistor and switched it on. It played a song from a film called Chemmin. It was the story of a poor girl who was forced to marry a fisherman from a neighboring beach, though she loves someone else. When the fisherman finds out about his new wife's old lover, he sets out to sea in his little boat, though he knows that a storm is brewing. It's dark, and the wind rises. A whirlpool spins up from the ocean bed. There is storm music, and the fisherman drowns, sucked to the bottom of the sea in the vortex of the whirlpool. The lovers make a suicide pact and are found the next morning washed up on the beach with their arms around each other. So everybody dies, the fisherman, his wife, her lover, and a shark that has no part in the story but dies anyway. The sea claims them all. In the blue cross-stitch darkness laced with edges of light, with cross-stitch roses on her sleepy cheek, Amu and her twins, one on either side of her, sang softly with the tangerine radio. The song that fisherwomen sang to the sad young bride as they braided her hair and prepared her for her wedding to a man she didn't love. Pandoru mukkuven muttinabui. Once a fisherman went to sea. Padinyaran kaatattu mungipoi. The west wind blew and swallowed his boat. An airport ferry frock stood on the floor, supported by its own froth and stiffness. Outside in the mittam, crisp saris lay in rows and crispened in the sun, off-white and gold. Small pebbles nestled in their starched creases and had to be shaken out before the saris were folded and taken in to be ironed. Areti penne pirichibui. His wife on the shore went astray. The electrocuted elephant, not Kochidamban, in Etimanur, was cremated. A giant burning cart was erected on the highway. The engineers of the concerned municipality sawed off the tusks and shared them unofficially, unequally. 80 tins of pure ghee were poured over the elephant to feed the fire. The smoke rose in dense fumes and arranged itself in complex patterns against the sky. People crowded around at a safe distance, read meanings into them. There were lots of flies. Kadalamma avane konduvai. So Mother Ocean rose and took him away. Pariah kites dropped into nearby trees to supervise the supervision of the last rites of the dead elephant. They hoped, not without reason, for pickings of giant innards, an enormous gallbladder perhaps, or a charred, gigantic spleen. They weren't disappointed, nor wholly satisfied. Amu noticed that both her children were covered in a fine dust, like two pieces of lightly sugar-dusted, unidentical cake. Rahel had a blonde curl lodged among her black ones, a curl from Velitha's backyard. Amu picked it out. "I've told you before," she said. "I don't want you going to his house. It will only cause trouble." What trouble, she didn't say. She didn't know. Somehow, by not mentioning his name, she knew that she had drawn him into the tousled intimacy of that blue cross-stitch afternoon and the song from the tangerine transistor. By not mentioning his name, she sensed that a pact had been forged between her dream and the world, and that the midwives of that pact were, or would be, her sawdust-coated two-egg twins. She knew who he was, the god of loss, the god of small things. Of course she did. She switched off the tangerine radio. In the afternoon silence, laced with edges of light, her children curled into the warmth of her, the smell of her. They covered their heads with her hair. They sensed somehow that in her sleep she had traveled away from them. They summoned her back now with the palms of their small hands laid flat against the bare skin of her midriff, between her petticoat and her blouse. They loved the fact that the brown of the backs of their hands was the exact brown of their mother's stomach skin. "Esther, look," Rahel said, plucking at the line of soft down that led southwards from Amu's belly button. "Here is where we kicked you," Esther traced a wandering silver stretch mark with his finger. "Was it in the bus, Amu? On the winding estate road? When Baba had to hold your tummy? Did you have to buy tickets? Did we hurt you?" And then, keeping her voice casual, Rahel's question. "Do you think he may have lost our address?" Just the hint of a pause in the rhythm of Amu's breathing made Esther touch Rahel's middle finger with his, and middle finger to middle finger on their beautiful mother's midriff. They abandoned that line of questioning. "That's Esther's kick, and that's mine," Rahel said. "And that's Esther's, and that's mine." Between them, they apportioned their mother's seven silver stretch marks. Then Rahel put her mouth on Amu's stomach and sucked at it, pulling the soft flesh into her mouth and drawing her head back to admire the shining oval of spit and the faint red imprint of her teeth on her mother's skin. Amu wondered at the transparency of that kiss. It was a clear-as-glass kiss, unclouded by passion or desire, that pair of dogs that sleep so soundly inside children, waiting for them to grow up. It was a kiss that demanded no kiss back. Not a cloudy kiss full of questions that wanted answers, like the kisses of cheerful one-armed men in dreams. Amu grew tired of their proprietary handling of her. She wanted her body back. It was hers. She shrugged her children off the way a bitch shrugs off her pups when she's had enough of them. She sat up and twisted her hair into a knot at the nape of her neck. Then she swung her legs off the bed, walked to the window, and drew back the curtains. Slanting afternoon light flooded the room and brightened two children on the bed. The twins heard the lock turning in Amu's bathroom door. Click. Amu looked at herself in the long mirror on the bathroom door, and the specter of her future appeared in it to mock her, pickled, gray, roomy-eyed. Cross-stitch roses on a slack, sunken cheek, withered breasts that hung like weighted socks, dry as a bone between her legs, the hair feather-white. Spare, as brittle as a pressed fern. Skin that flaked and shed like snow. Amu shivered. With that cold feeling on a hot afternoon that life had been lived, that her cup was full of dust, that the air, the sky, the trees, the sun, the rain, the light and darkness were all slowly turning to sand. That sand would fill her nostrils, her lungs, her mouth, would pull her down, leaving on the surface a spinning swirl like crabs leave, when they burrow downwards on a beach. Amu undressed and put a red toothbrush under her breast to see if it would stay. It didn't. Where she touched herself, her flesh was taut and smooth. Under her hands, her nipples wrinkled and hardened like dark nuts, pulling at the soft skin on her breasts. The thin line of down from her belly button led over the gentle curve of the base of her belly to her dark triangle. Like an arrow directing a lost traveler, an inexperienced lover. She undid her hair and turned around to see how long it had grown. It fell in waves and curls and disobedient frizzy wisps, soft on the inside, coarser on the outside, to just below where her small, strong waist began its curve out towards her hips. The bathroom was hot. Small beads of sweat studded her skin like diamonds. Then they broke and trickled down. Sweat ran down the recessed line of her spine. She looked a little critically at her round, heavy behind, not big in itself, not big per se, as Charco of Oxford would no doubt have put it, big only because the rest of her was so slender. It belonged on another more voluptuous body. She had to admit that they would happily support a toothbrush apiece, perhaps two. She laughed out loud at the idea of walking naked down Imanum with an array of colored toothbrushes sticking out from either cheek of her bottom. She silenced herself quickly. She saw a wisp of madness escape from its bottle and caper triumphantly around the bathroom. Amu worried about madness. Mamachi said it ran in their family, that it came on people suddenly and caught them unawares. There was Patelamai, who at the age of 65 began to take her clothes off and run naked along the river singing to the fish. There was Thumbichachan, who searched his shit every morning with a knitting needle for a gold tooth he had swallowed years ago. And Dr. Muttachan, who had to be removed from his own wedding in a sack. Would future generations say, there was Amu, Amu Aip, married a Bengali, went quite mad, died young, in a cheap lodge somewhere. Charco said that the high incidence of insanity among Syrian Christians was the price they paid for inbreeding. Mamachi said it wasn't. Amu gathered up her heavy hair, wrapped it around her face, and peered down the road to age and death through its parted strands, like a medieval executioner peering through the tilted eye slits of his peaked black hood at the executionee. A slender, naked executioner, with dark nipples and deep dimples when she smiled, with seven silver stretch marks from her two egg twins, born to her by candlelight amid news of a lost war. It wasn't what lay at the end of her road that frightened Amu, as much as the nature of the road itself. No milestones marked its progress. No trees grew along it. No dappled shadows shaded it. No mists rolled over it, no birds circled it, no twists, no turns or hairpin bends obscured even momentarily her clear view of the end. This filled Amu with an awful dread, because she was not the kind of woman who wanted her future told. She dreaded it too much. So if she were granted one small wish, perhaps it would only have been not to know. Not to know what each day held in store for her. Not to know where she might be, next month, next year, 10 years on. Not to know which way her road might turn and what lay beyond the bend. And Amu knew, or thought she knew, which was really just as bad, because if in a dream you've eaten fish, it means you've eaten fish. And what Amu knew, or thought she knew, smelled of the vapid, vinegary fumes that rose from the cement vats of Paradise Pickles. Fumes that wrinkled youth and pickled futures. Hooded in her own hair, Amu leaned against herself in the bathroom mirror and tried to weep. For herself. For the god of small things. For the sugar-dusted twin midwives of her dream. That afternoon, While in the bathroom, the fates conspired to horribly alter the course of their mysterious mother's road. While in Velitha's backyard, an old boat waited for them. While in a yellow church, a young bat waited to be born. In their mother's bedroom, Esther stood on his head, on Rahel's bomb. The bedroom with blue curtains and yellow wasps that worried the window panes. The bedroom whose walls would soon learn their harrowing secrets. The bedroom into which Amu would first be locked and then lock herself. Whose door Chako, crazed by grief 4 days after Sophie Moll's funeral, would batter down. Get out of my house before I break every bone in your body. My house, my pineapples, my pickle. After that, for years, Rahel would dream this dream. A fat man, faceless, kneeling beside a woman's corpse, hacking its hair off, breaking every bone in its body, snapping even the little ones, the fingers, the ear bones cracked like twigs. Snap, snap. The soft sound of breaking bones. A pianist killing the piano keys, even the black ones. And Rahel, though years later in the electric crematorium she would use the slipperiness of sweat to slither out of Charco's grasp, loved them both, the player and the piano, the killer and the corpse. As the door was slowly battered down, to control the trembling of her hands, Amu would hem the ends of Rahel's ribbons that didn't need hemming. Promise me you'll always love each other, she'd say, as she drew her children to her. Promise, Esther and Rahel would say, not finding words with which to tell her that for them there was no each, no other. Twin millstones and their mother. Numb millstones. What they had done would return to empty them. But that would be later. Later. A deep-sounding bell in a mossy well, shivery and furred, like moths' feet. At the time, there would only be incoherence, as though meaning had slunk out of things and left them fragmented, disconnected. The glint of Amu's needle, the color of a ribbon, the weave of the cross-stitch counterpane, a door slowly breaking. Isolated things that didn't mean anything. As though the intelligence that decodes life's hidden patterns, that connects reflections to images, glints to light, weaves to fabrics, needles to thread, walls to rooms, love to fear, to anger, to remorse, was suddenly lost. Pack your things and go, Chako would say, stepping over the debris, looming over them, a chrome door handle in his hand. Suddenly, strangely calm, surprised at his own strength, his bigness, his bullying power, the enormity of his own terrible grief. Red, the color of splintered doorwood. Amu, quiet outside, shaking inside, wouldn't look up from her unnecessary hemming. The tin of colored ribbons would lie open on her lap, in the room where she had lost her locust's stand eye. The same room in which, after the twin expert from Hyderabad had replied, Amu would pack Esther's little trunk and khaki holdall. 12 sleeveless cotton vests. 12 half-sleeved cotton vests. Esther, here's your name on them in ink. His socks, his drainpipe trousers, his pointy collared shirts, his beige and pointy shoes from where the angry feelings came. His Elvis records, his calcium tablets and Vitalin syrup, his free giraffe that came with the Vitalin. His books of knowledge, volumes 1 to 4. No, sweetheart, there won't be a river there to fish in. His white leather zip-up Bible with an imperial entomologist's amethyst cufflink on the zip. His mug, his soap, his advance birthday present that he mustn't open. 40 green inland letter forms. Look, Esther, I've written our address on it. All you have to do is fold it. See if you can fold it yourself. And Esther would fold the green inland letter neatly along the dotted lines that said, fold here, and look up at Amu with a smile that broke her heart. Promise me you'll write.
even when you don't have any news. Promise, Esther would say, not wholly cognizant of his situation. The sharp edge of his apprehensions blunted by this sudden wealth of worldly possessions. They were his, and had his name on them.